it potentially could arise on the roof that's distinct from Spanish tile, for instance, I would like to suggest that you might talk to the gentleman who experienced this particular occasion. I would be interested because we have a redwood shape, a shingle roof, however one defines it. And we have a fireplace. I've given some thought about it. There must be a reason why you would have sparks sufficiently large that wouldn't go out by the time they'd gone in through the chimney and up and out and down again. Was the problem the nature of the wood? Was the problem an unusual flow of air? That's a point, because there's no reason not to be advised when you have a situation like that. I think it's well worth considering. I have a news release which was sent to us on Thursday. We came up yesterday, and the reason we are here, in a sense, is the request of our brethren in Monterey. Mr. Coulter thought that it might be an opportunity to be here at Pentecost, and since the probability is that Mr. Herbert Armstrong or Mr. Ted Armstrong will be speaking in Pasadena and have the services piped in to our Imperial AM congregation, there was no logical reason for all of us to remain at the Imperial AM, since Mr. Rice was going to be speaking anyway, and myself, I just simply opted out, and Mr. Rice will be able to speak anyway. The other was that I have wanted for some few years to have my wife see a private rose garden in Browns Valley area, the Tillotson residence, where over I don't know how many years, probably a full generation, the roses have been grown. Now, my wife is not a rose bug. We have those. But there was an opportunity to combine the chance to be with the brethren in Monterey at no extra cost, because it was right on the route of coming from Monterey here to the area of Los Gatos, where the O'Dells live, and we stayed last night. It's a very small place, but it is one of those things that you've never had the opportunity or are interested in roses or gardening plants. I think that you will find it a rewarding experience. But regarding this news release, so this was issued at Big Sandy, Texas, before the press. Ambassador College, says the news release, and I will take the liberty of reading it here, will begin its 31st academic year in August 1977 with a consolidation of its two campuses, according to College President Garner Ted Armstrong. The Pasadena institution will be expanded in size and scope with transfer of the college's Big Sandy, Texas student body to Pasadena. The Big Sandy campus will be converted to facilitate programs of the Worldwide Church of God. Consolidation of the two educational programs at a single location was proposed nearly a year ago, and the final decision was made by the president today. Enrollment at the Pasadena campus for the current year was 830, and next year's enrollment is estimated to be between 1,000 and 1,100. Next year's meaning this coming August, September to the following May. The additional 250 students will be facilitated in existing college buildings. The reason for consolidation and expansion of Ambassador College is to resolve to continue the progress begun so long ago to ensure Ambassador flourishes, that it grows in academic excellence and substance, and that it becomes truly one of the finest small colleges in existence, according to President Armstrong. The college, which is currently a candidate for regional accreditation by the Western Association of Schools and Colleges, speaking to the Pasadena campus, will invest its major long-term resources into development and enhancement of the expanding Pasadena program. President Armstrong assessed, however, that the character of Ambassador College will never change. It will continue to emphasize the principles and personal qualities that lead to individual success. Ambassador will not become a huge megaversity to tens of thousands of students. The concept is to ultimately develop a small university with the same superior environmental standards we've always maintained. President Armstrong also outlined the advantages of developing a single college rather than operating separate colleges or campuses offering nearly identical programs. Consolidation into one institution will allow a broader range of academic programs while providing more areas of specialization. The Big Sandy campus will now become the permanent location for Worldwide Church of God's Youth Opportunities United program, YOU, that provides the church youth with a summer camp, national athletic tournaments, scholarships, and other individual development opportunities, hence the closing of the Minnesota grounds. The Big Sandy campus will continue to serve as the headquarters site for the Worldwide Church of God Convention Service, which plans and operates the church's festivals. More than 80,000 U.S. and Canadian members attend these events at various locations around the nation. And that's what it had been last year. It dropped off because of the spiritual state of too many. Down to around 75,000, I'll add. The Big Sandy facility itself is scheduled in September as a convention site for some 9,000 people. The Big Sandy grounds will also serve as a regional headquarters for the church. That region includes Texas, New Mexico, and parts of Louisiana, Oklahoma, Arkansas. It is one of 11 such regions in the United States, and that is the conclusion of this statement. I think it's quite appropriate for you to realize that this is a statement to the press and not everything is everybody's business. Hence the comment with respect to our recent cash flow situation is not included. But there is no doubt that that precipitated the final decision. If you remember Mr. Herbert Armstrong's co-worker letter, was it a letter to the members, I guess, instead, in which he pointed out the probability that the Big Sandy campus will have to be closed in terms of a separate campus. This is the special day in which we are asked, in terms of what we say, therefore, to discuss matters that would seem appropriate to asking all of the brethren worldwide to fast. So I will discuss certain matters pertaining to the work and individuals here that might give you some help to avoid pitfalls and also to inform you of things that perhaps you ought to know in a more direct way. I discussed with Mr. Aaron O'Dell the fact that one of the problems that always develops when a work gets larger is that news circulates faster than the official pipeline. That is, there's apparently a more effective means of conveying it than the work has adopted. We were kidding last night that there were the three normal methods, telegraph, telephone, telewoman. But that was not my idea. But I will not betray which of the brethren said it. But he loves his wife anyway. In any case, we have here a report issued certainly, probably Wednesday. I got a copy Thursday. The chance for any of you to hear it normally would be in the next bulletin 1 or 2 weeks hence. And, that's what happened. Everybody in the church will have heard it through some other means. And it is one of the things we have to be aware of and not let news coming from the side or through other individual church channels obscure our responsibility to convey it formally and appropriately. I don't think we have to owe it to the brethren to reveal to them 2 weeks in advance before we mention it to the press. Anyway, there is no doubt that the reason for the pressure to make the decision now, though normally one makes it a year in advance of the closing of an institution, academically speaking, is the cash flow problem, and we might just as well face up to resolving that problem by terminating an extra campus if we can combine the various aspects as pointed up in this report. I would draw attention to the fact that in every institution, as in any family, some decisions are postponed. I have given a sermon which I will not hear, and it has to do with the question of how the government of God has operated in the church through the centuries. And there is no doubt that such government varies in terms of how brethren comprehend it, how those leading in the church administer it. The point now is that if we want to understand something of the government of God, we also have another parallel. If Christ rules the church, we also learn in the marriage ceremony that Christ is the head of the husband, as the husband is the head of the wife. And we notice how often women would be willing to say that it doesn't appear that Christ rules that directly over the husband, based on some of the mistakes that husbands are allowed to make. Or, even if they're not mistakes, based on the differences that different men, or the differences in decisions that different men will make given similar set of circumstances. Which brings up the fact that if in handling private personal finances a man is accountable to God, and too few realize it, and too few women perhaps realize it, and there is a proper relationship between the two in terms of where the responsibility lies and how one makes it work. In the same way, we have to acknowledge that Christ's relationship to the church should not be that different from his relationship to a husband in a family, for the simple reason that marriage is a type of the relationship of the church to Christ. Am I coming clear on this to you? But we often overlook this matter, see? Now, if these variations can happen, then it is also very probable in administering the responsibility financially of the church that we will not all agree with the kind of decisions that are made. That is, that I might have made a different decision than the one that was made. I would be candid and say, in my estimation, the Big Sandy campus should have been closed not later than a year ago, and probably should have been closed when the Brick and Wood campus was, and it should have been closed even earlier. That's my point of view. It was not done. We had a special offering to help make up part of the difference. But on the other hand, it's not my decision, and I contributed to the offering. But I think we have to, I'm being plain here, I'm sure that Mr. Armstrong long, long ago had misgivings for having three campuses anyway, Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And I think it was a very difficult decision for Mr. Ted Armstrong to say that the campus had to be terminated as a separate branch of Ambassador College in Big Sandy, which he had such an attachment for. And on this basis, however, we have to be willing to say yes or no to various things that come along. And I'm mentioning this because if I'm pointing up that there are different points of view that one might have, we have to recognize that whether at this stage in the state of the church, whether we agree with every decision that is made, we all have to live with it and pitch in and do our part, and to convey information when proper and necessary. But we don't have to become all emotionally upset and disturbed if decisions are made a little late. Hopefully, some decisions in the future won't have to be made so late and can be made in advance before pressure occurs. One of the problems that most people have, and the Church of God has, it's a problem that most men and most women and everybody does. We tend to make the final decision when we are forced to. Otherwise, we postpone a decision. And if you think the work has done this, the answer is yes. And if you think you have never done it, the answer is yes. answer is, you're wrong. It is a human trait. We have to recognize it. That it is a human trait is something that Christ allows, but he also advises in the Bible against. That is, I think we need to look a little more in terms of what our real responsibility is, and sometimes we have to learn lessons. We are dealing momentarily, Mr. Joseph DeCopt and I, with a man who quit his job because his superior, he's a church member, his superior was, in a sense, maybe even being influenced by a demon to make his position very difficult because of his beliefs or his faith and his practice. The man quit the job before he gave the thought of how he was going to have money to pay his monthly obligations, because you can't suddenly get on unemployment and immediately receive money. Now he has another job. Within 2 months or a month, he has another job, but you don't get paid the first day you start to work. You get paid after about 2 weeks. This man never thought that it would have been a whole lot wiser for him, with his job, to perhaps have a co-signer and borrow money that would tide him over before he quit. And now we have to decide whether we should use the third tide or emergency fund to help him in this situation. You know, we sometimes do learn a lesson and sometimes we don't. And Christ allows the church to make far more decisions on its own than perhaps we ever thought. And so we do recognize that not everything we might agree with is the way something is done. But what is most important is that we don't get angry at Christ for letting it be that way, or those to whom he may work more directly in certain management responsibilities before allowing it. I know a man in the business office, I need not mention a name, it's unimportant, who has addressed the question of cash flow, who has presented it at the highest levels in the work, and pointed up many, many months ago the importance of making decisions when the indications of a cash flow problem occur. Now, we are in a situation where the total income of the work is good by any normal standard, and where the outgo ultimately will be good by contrast, but where inflation's rate, now running on the basis of April, is something like 0.8% a month or 9.6 a year, so the inflation rate in this country is hardly likely to be less than 7 to 9% for this whole year, and maybe more, but probably we'll just leave it at that for the moment. Now, with an inflation rate that therefore would demand certainly a, shall I say, a 9 or an 8% cut in the efforts of the work just to keep pace. If our income is stable, if inflation goes up, we must cut back in the work something like 1 unit out of every 8 or 9 things we do. And I don't think this is fully realized in one's own private budget. Therefore, it wasn't realized in the work, and I do not believe that even at the level of Mr. Herbert Armstrong and Mr. Ted Armstrong, they were fully aware of the fact that you can't make a decision in January that has a budgetary effect in July or December, so that by the end of December we come out even, because between January and December you have your cash flow problem. That is, you've got to make a decision so that somewhere along the line, the outgo and the income are in such a relationship that you catch up and you have enough cushion to work with. The decision to close the Big Sandy campus will help us financially, not in 77, but in 78. Because you suddenly, if you consolidate, you suddenly don't terminate everybody. You suddenly don't sell a property. You can't overnight sell something. If we put a plane up for sale, we may wait 6 months before somebody buys it. The decision looks good on paper because so many months from now, we won't have the maintenance. But in the meantime, we still own it. We still pay. So I do believe that we have the problem. And one of the things we all, and this pertains to your family life, it pertains to mine, it pertains to the work. The important thing on a day when we are fasting and asking God for help is that men's recommendations that are sound and solid do come through and ring true and are plain. At the highest levels where decisions are made so that we can make these decisions in advance of the work's urgent need, point one, and two, that we maintain a right attitude with respect to it, and all those three who have to make these decisions come to see it clearly and make it well enough in advance that we don't have the pressures, and in fact we can go ahead and do more things in areas that we need to be able to do. One of the problems, of course, is that there are people who become upset whenever a decision is made that is different than the one they might have made. This has been true in the history of the work from the beginning. And probably one of the reasons the devil is what he is that he became upset with the fact that God didn't do it his way. And he let himself become bitter. So, brethren, I think that if we want to know what it is we should pray about, there are certain things that we can publicly describe. And there are other things, the private problems of people that don't belong in public in any discussion. But I think I can handle this in a way that it really shows there's very little difference between what we do as individuals and what the work might do. And after all, Mr. Herbert Armstrong or Mr. Ted Armstrong or Mr. Rader or Mr. Ray Wright or whoever you want to point up as fundamentally making major decisions in terms of financially of policy, we have to recognize that these men are called of God as you and I. They have been given certain responsibilities, and we all have to work with tendencies to hope that it will get better, hope that we don't have to make these decisions. But there is no doubt that inflation has played a great role. If we didn't have inflation, we could practically keep going not having to make any of these decisions. There was a time, you know, we could keep going and add to because the growth rate itself was somewhere between 30% and 20%. But it gradually dropped off because when you have inflation, it inevitably eats away at the available offerings that people can give. And therefore, instead of going ahead, when we have a more stable income instead of a large growth rate, and then an inflation rate from 6 to 14% over the past several years, which is what it has been in terms of our work, why we have to cut back into major areas that we cannot continue. I'd like to comment now on some other aspects that we might consider in our concern for the work and prayer and responsibility. I tried to analyze on the basis of discussion what are the local matters or problems here that would be of special benefit. At headquarters, we have different problems there. There's a far greater awareness of every decision that is made and even decisions that are never made. First of all, there is a trend in any organization that grows larger. When changes are made, we often have a situation where individuals come up with ideas that might be in advance of some in the ministry. Now, it was different, as you would understand, when Mr. Herbert Armstrong's eyes and ears and age were in the 40s or 50s or 60s or 70s, earlier 70s, when he had the capacity, in terms of the natural senses, to be in as much the lead as anybody in the church. But you come to a time in age where you can no longer read as much, you can no longer hear as well, and you no longer have the energy to study as often. Yet in terms of making major decisions, Mr. Herbert Armstrong has a great responsibility, though much of the executive decisions pass to his son presently, and others sharing various levels of responsibility. But it is therefore likely that somebody else will come up with ideas that might be in advance of the leadership in the church. And therefore, what we have is a situation in which the status of the leadership and or the ministry, its headquarters at the local level, will vary. But there was a time when most people heard something from the pulpit, when we were asked to do it, or we were asked to study something and to put it in our minds and in our lives, that we went ahead and did it because it's what the church asked. Then you grow big enough where there is leadership, and sometimes, therefore, the leadership in the church, as distinct from the local level, is a little slower to make decisions when you have a small congregation. As Mr. Armstrong could discuss a topic here with two or three people, and this was the size and the bulk of the church at the Feast of Tabernacles, and I have attended the Feast of Tabernacles in 1948, that was smaller than this half of the room, rather, and see, it's quite different when, as a leader, he could talk to the brethren and come up with something new, and we all march together. But it doesn't happen that way anymore, because an idea may arise in South Africa that the church in Pasadena has to agree with later, as an illustration, or it may arise in New York. And when the administration, or at the level of Mr. Armstrong, make changes, it is often because brethren have already anticipated it, come up with it, and the view of the ministry or administration and the image is changed, and so instead of saying, let's do it, you know, let's incorporate it, wasn't that something remarkable that we never thought of before, the new response becomes, but do I have to do it? We know it's true, but do I have to do it? In other words, this is one of the things that I really need to, that I really have to. And that leads to the next question, that after a new thought is presented, sometimes you come to the next step, but is it true? And then you take the next step after that and say, well, of course I attend church, but I don't let it affect me. You know, you take these various steps until finally we don't attend. And so we had a situation at headquarters in Pasadena over many past months, where approximately only half of the people in the entire Los Angeles basin and related areas, I'm not talking about Los Angeles or Glendale churches, but those who attend the four headquarters church of Pasadena, probably one half were consistently not attending. It's a state of mind. It's not good. Because it is not merely what you get or think you don't get, it is also as important in terms of what you give by your presence, as well as the thoughts you have that you share with others on a day like this. And if you're crippled, in a wheelchair, you're in your 90s, and we have one lady in our Imperial AM congregation, it is as important for her to be there that others learn to be concerned for her as it is for her to be there in terms of what she hears, which is very limited. She has a hearing aid at her age, and she has to do a lot of rethinking of what is said as a result of her daughter, who is approximately 70, I guess, now. So she's well into her 90s, as you see. And she has to help her after services at other times to convey to her what you and I hear and take for granted. But these are trends that can set in, and I think you have to look at your state. When someone says, but do I have to do it? Or you finally get to question even the matter of whether it's true, and then you finally don't let it affect you at all. You are drifting in the direction of what Mr. Armstrong says that most people don't understand, that's Protestantism, where the church and religion, for too many, is a compartment of life. And in religion, they are one thing in one way. And afterward, in the other 6 days of the week, there's something else. They're in labor, they're in politics, they're in business, and they don't let religion affect either politics, labor, or business, whatever their function may be. And so there has developed an aspect that is unfortunate in terms of our view of what the church is doing. Thus, what we are doing is viewed as a good work, but more and more people say, but it isn't necessarily the work. It's a good work. And the focus is becoming blurred in the minds of many. And this kind of thing can develop even in an area as sound and stable as our community here is. What we ought to do is analyze what we mean by a way of life. First of all, when we don't let it affect us, what we are saying is that we really have another way of life than that which is expounded in the church. Now, the function of the church should be very clearly and simply understood. It is a means, not the only means, because we have the printed message as a vehicle, we have radio or television, and other aspects of the conduct of the work, but the primary function taking the church as a whole, irrespective of the media use, irrespective of the church congregational assembly on the Sabbath, although this is the major means, it is to convey information that God wants man to have. He first of all has done it in this book we call the Bible. But after conveying it in the pages of the Bible, there is a necessity, since it is a written word, and human beings are not all up to the same level of comprehending a written word. There is also the need of the exposition of it in an oral sense, such as we have in a sermon. Acts 2:38 discusses the ways of life. We won't go into the rest of the background of it, but I'm picking the phrase out of Acts 2:28. It was a mistake, I think I said. Anyway, Acts 2:28. It speaks of the ways of life. That is, the very various aspects of life that are being conveyed. Now, Christianity didn't start out, Peter didn't start out preaching, quote, Christianity, unquote. The apostles never thought of themselves as Christians to start with in Jerusalem. Not until years later were they called Christians, first at Antioch. You read this, of course, in the book of Acts. It rather was an awareness that the teaching of God, Torah in the Hebrew, or law, it was a teaching, not law in the sense of what we have in Sacramento. The teaching is in the Bible. And this teaching was the basis of what it meant to be a Jew, someone who lived in accordance with the book. But the book was in, essentially, the letter of the law. Because the law that was given or the teaching was what we now call the Old Covenant, or the Ten Commandments. And after all, the Ten Commandments is said, in one point, you shall not commit adultery, left a lot of loopholes. The Ten Commandments, as you read it, covers all aspects of life if you have the wit to see. But most people approach it as a lawyer, or as Nixon might have, based on his own statement. I think that's one of the tragedies of the whole legal profession. But what is not included, therefore, is excluded, and you can do as you please. And so, what we had in the congregation of Israel, or Judah, in the New Testament time, are people who looked at the law in terms of what was required of them, and they built little fences around so they wouldn't transgress those things which God expressly forbade. Those were the teachings and laws of the elders, the oral traditions. But then what was not expressly asked of us or forbidden by God, around which men drew a little bigger fence, that was what people left themselves free to do, or thought they could be free to do. Jesus came along in this congregation and espoused a way of life, speaking broadly, or the various ways of life that govern the different sections of our lives. Our actions, our thinking, our business, our family. And it was an exposition of the law in terms of its intent and purpose, probably best understood in Matthew chapter 5. And it was referred to now uncommonly in the book of Acts, for instance in 9 verse 2, as this way. And people were persecuted, if any, of this way. That is, people who, within the congregation of Judah, or Israel, to use the Old Testament term, who actually lived in accordance with a way that was beyond the mere letter of the law. It went deeper. And this is what has been disappearing from the Church of God in the present decade in particular. A departure from the ideal that you take a look at the Bible and you seek to apply what it says to all aspects of your life. And what is therefore not expressly stated, you seek to find out anyway, whether through the Bible or other means, because the Bible is essentially a revelation of spiritual matters, but life is composed of far more than spirit. You're fleshly, you're physical. And there are other things we can learn as well. And we can more readily evaluate the physical by the scientific means available to us. But we have no means physically of evaluating the spiritual, which had to be revealed. And also certain things that we couldn't have discerned that often do involve the physical, of which unclean meats is one simple illustration. We read in Acts chapter 19 also, and though many of you have known of these verses, verses 9 and verse 23, it speaks of that way. On two occasions. But it doesn't matter the phraseology, it merely is using a term on the basis of the context. But every time what you have is a concept of a way. Elsewhere it is called a way of salvation. I didn't want to use that because people think, well, if it's a way of salvation, then it covers nothing else, only salvation. And salvation is supposed to be spiritual and everything else is excluded. That's an aspect, but it isn't the only one. And the first and the primary introduction of these terms is specifically that one in Acts 2:28, the ways of life. Life as we live it, and life eternal. And the way we ought to go. In other words, the way God lives and acts and thinks, as expressed in the law, magnified in the person and teachings of Jesus Christ, who was the Son of God. Acts 22:4 speaks of this way. Now, when we see it, we get right back to the crisis which the church has faced for now over half a decade. And it is a crisis something like this. There was a time we were united by a way of life. Now we are divided by lifestyle. This is one of the problems. There is a lifestyle that some people adopt and others don't appreciate. We are not all seeking to broaden our perspective to the point where every valuable thing we can appreciate and share in, whether we, let's say, make it fundamental to our life, but we do not exclude others on the basis of variation. There was a time when we focused in on the way of life where we were able to discern the way of the world. Now, lifestyles are of such a nature that it is very difficult for most people to discern the difference between the ways of the world and the way of life. Because some in the world have adopted one lifestyle and some another, and very many of these styles have something in common with some obvious aspect of the Bible. You know, there was a time when probably the only church, and I would say, as far as we're concerned, probably the only important Sabbath-keeping church that encouraged natural childbirth was the Church of God. Now, you can go to the world and have, at the leading bookstore in Pasadena, I probably can pick up half a dozen books on natural childbirth that are acceptable, available. Probably, if I'd go into the children's section and the paperback section at this one bookstore, I would pick up no less than a dozen books on natural childbirth. There are aspects, in other words, that the Church of God once stood for that are now being realized even in the world. So the world has accepted some truth, not because it came from us, but it has accepted certain truths that it should have had all along, and that many nations in the world have had. Now, on the other hand, it is an interesting thing that we then, at the same time, begin to adopt more and more things of the world which have no parallel in the Bible. I would say there was a time when the concept of growing organic food was practically limited to a few people in Hollywood who were concerned for how they looked in the movies in their older age. It was limited to, let's say, Mr. Rodale and to the Seventh-day Adventists and the Church of God. Today it is a giant industry all over the country and all over the world. The world has adopted certain things. There was a time, beginning in the 20s and 30s of this generation, when women were discouraged from nursing children. And it took the hippies to reintroduce the nursing of children at the same time when they were imbibing drugs. See? The drug culture and nursing babies went hand in hand in the world. So you know what's happening? Well, in the church, we still keep up the idea of nursing children. And no small number of young people are introducing drugs in the church. That's the state of affairs. And when Mr. Armstrong asks us to fast and pray, he may not know everything I'm telling you, and he's likely to know some things I wouldn't think of telling you. We have today a growing problem with alcoholism in the church. You see, there was a time when the church pointed up the foolishness of people who had understood the Bible incorrectly, where outside and in the religious world we had as a whole people who interpreted temperance as prohibition. Now when you clarify that and make it plain, then there will be people who take liberty. And they will not stop where temperance says to stop. That is the true definition of temperance. They will go on and become, unfortunately, in some instances, alcoholics. We now have probably an alcoholic problem that is approaching about the same percentage that we have in the world around us. Maybe not in a small congregation like this area, but in your larger metropolitan areas, we have numerous alcoholics in the church. Some were before they came in the church. That we can understand, and we work with them. There are others who became that in the church, and one or two who became that in the ministry, and unnecessarily. We've had to deal with the problem. Happily, one man has publicly acknowledged his problem, which Mr. Nixon has yet to do, to the point where he could be forgiven, and this man, Mr. Hampton, Dale Hampton, is able to speak in the pulpit about the problem. And people are able and willing to listen, because he has been willing finally to face up to what was a weakness that he could not wrestle with and win for years. Barriers are down. It isn't like it used to be where practically everything the world did was wrong. The devil learned that if the world was that wrong, more and more people would become interested in us. And this would seem to be the way, the work, the church that God was using. You went somewhere else and you just had nothing but error. That long, more and more people would become interested in us. And this would seem to be the way, the work, the church that God was using. You went somewhere else and you just had nothing but error. Now, the devil found that if he wants to stop both the work of the church and he wants to upset those within and destroy them, what he has to do is introduce more and more of a form of truth into the world until people in the world don't see the difference between the world and the church. And finally, young people growing up in the church don't see the difference between the church and the world. And that's what we have. It isn't people who are 70s and 80s who are getting on drugs. It's young people. It isn't our elderly people who are suddenly going in for alcoholism. Most people don't go in for that. They go in for alcohol and it becomes the ism. But nevertheless, the fact remains, you see, that today it would be far more difficult for young people growing up in the church to discern the difference. I know a simple example with our children. The one reason we moved from near the campus in Pasadena was due to the fact that other young people in the church often did things that were quite inappropriate or wrong in our estimation. And our children found it much more difficult to discern between good and evil when those children in the church were doing both and seemed to be nice. You know, friendly, they were in Imperial schools, which then were open, our day school and high school program, and they sat in church. But what they did in private was sometimes good and sometimes evil, and the parents weren't as responsible as they should have been. We moved out into a public school where it was so obvious that practically everything most people were doing was wrong and contrary, and our children were able to see the difference immediately. It is very important that as parents, we learn to point up to the children the principles of right and wrong, and also the fact that in a world in which the devil runs it, the more he can mix up good and evil so you can't discern it, the more likely he will fool people in the church as well as those who are already deceived outside. So this is one of the problems we have to face in every area we work in. The devil hasn't had, as a whole, to confuse chemistry because that's not our primary issue. In other words, our greatest enemies are not chemists. On the other hand, the devil has had to confuse food chemistry. Because that is an issue which even God himself stresses. And so we have to be aware of the biblical principle, be aware of the presence of the devil. And the more likely you will have something that is physical knowledge paralleling something in the Bible, the more likely the devil has his hand in confusing the knowledge in that area. It therefore becomes important that we don't go off the deep end in any one of these areas, which has some parallel, as nutrition does, with the Bible. I use that as a simple illustration of some of the problems we might have in our study and understanding beside those I've already mentioned. We come to a place where also, as groups, we allow ourselves liberties that we never allowed before. We were discussing this morning briefly that we can have groups of people in God's church who even puzzle or ponder whether your vocabulary should include such terms as gee and gosh and darn and golly and, you know, the list of them. This is a vocabulary list that I'm giving and not profanity. Jesus himself said on one occasion that we're going to be held accountable for every idle word. And we are asked that our speech be of a nature that is above reproach. What we really ought to do in an area as small as this, since we're looking introspectively at this moment, is ask ourselves why we say what we do, why we use terms that we do, what do those terms actually represent in terms of our character, and how we are seen by other people. I don't think we have to make a religion over a matter such as this. But I will tell you plainly that people who were embarrassed to use Jesus decided G was better. And when they didn't want to use God, gosh did. Now, whether you realize it or not, most of these are pseudonyms for taking God's name in vain. And I think that God's people should have sense enough to ask in this way of life, both how we speak, how we think, what we eat, how we live, in every area, that we really analyze what the intent and purpose is. Now, instead of saying, but do I have to avoid it, or do I have to quit saying these words, what we really ought to ask is, what ought I to do? We tend to want to do everything that is not expressly forbidden. As I said, you know, there are certain ways of life in this world. There's the French way, the German way, the Russian way, and the American way, so to speak. The Russian way is that you are forbidden even that which is expressly allowed. And the German way is that you are allowed nothing that is not expressly permitted. The French way is that you are allowed even that which is expressly forbidden. The American way is that you are allowed anything that is not expressly forbidden. And these are all aspects of a way of life. If you go to these countries, you'll see it. We would say, keep off the law. If it doesn't say it, we think we can do it. In Germany, unless it says you may use the lawn, you must not. And if there is no sign, it means it's forbidden. In Russia, in that sense, it is forbidden even when it is allowed. You get the point. So we live in a society today which is quite interesting in that we tend to want to do anything that isn't expressly prohibited. We do not fill our minds with the concept, which is what the Bible is, that it sets out a fundamental pattern in which we ought to live. Now, when it comes to dress, the church for a while, and this was a symptom of a problem I think we didn't realize. And I think Mr. Armstrong didn't realize the symptom of the problem. That's not the way I want to word it. He didn't realize the symptom as distinct from the problem. I don't think any of us did. When we had to comment on what women should wear in terms of hemlines in the later 60s or whenever it started, maybe even the middle 60s, I forget. What we were actually addressing was the dress. What we should have been addressing was the attitude of the person, why the person wants to wear something like that. And what was happening is that women wanted at that time to begin in the church to go along with those fashions, even which were not as becoming, and to go along with many of the characteristics that, in fact, were motivated by, in the case of the manufacturer's greed, motivated by attention getting, motivated especially among some teenagers, by an act of rebellion. And what we have is a whole aspect today in terms of men's grooming, women's garb, in which we for a long time addressed, unfortunately, the effect but not the cause. The cause was, why do people do what they do? What is the motivating factor? And most of it was vanity. And, of course, among teenagers for a while in the 60s, it began to be a spirit of rebellion against an adult society, which in many cases was wrong. But the rebellion itself was not good, which ended in the drug cult and dropouts in society. The church, in fact, was made up of teenagers who went to these schools, where this was a problem. It was made up of people who were beginning spiritually to see the truth, who had already been caught up in a lot of the vanity of the world around us. And it crept into the church more and more. We have then a state of mind that we must be careful of, and I do believe that this congregation is reflective of it as a whole. And that is that we should seek to do what God asks us We should fill our minds with all the things that we are asked to do and seek to avoid all those things we are asked not to, and try to understand the breadth and the depth of those statements which are written in the Bible. Instead of trying to find loopholes, what we try to do is do more effectively what we are asked to do and try more effectively to avoid what we are asked to avoid. In which case, we will have very little time for Valentine and birthdays. Because there are many other things, you see, that we ought to be doing. Now we have an age in which, of course, birthday parties are common on the Ambassador College campus, and people are asked if they don't participate, what's wrong with you? But this is the new trend. Now we have never gone to the extreme that some few might have, speaking officially for the church, but unfortunately we're just drifting in the direction in many cases of the world. And I hope that in all these areas we really take a look. We respect the elderly as each passing year, as we always have. But how far we get into partying, and I put on a party for you and hope that you will put on a party for me, you know, this kind of thing. And this is what it will end up as. We've got to curb it. I would like to address another matter here that we should consider, and I think this is important enough to mention it and to pick out a personality. Necessarily, when there are problems in any institution that need to be addressed or worked on, we usually try to find somebody to focus in, and at this moment, undoubtedly, the man more people focus in on is Mr. Rader, Stanley Rader, than anyone else, who, from his Jewish background and his legal advice to the work over many years, probably now a score of years nearly, has in fact become baptized and has taken on certain major responsibilities that involve legal and financial matters in the work. The fact remains that it is very easy to have doubts about a person whom you do not know. Undoubtedly, it's of a similar nature, though for other reasons, that the early Christians had doubts about Paul. After all they knew was that he was clearly an outsider and a murderer at heart. And Mr. Rader, for many years, was an outsider. And as far as baptism is concerned, he is far younger than many of you, and therefore should be seen in that light, although his knowledge may be greater, having been brought up in the Jewish community and personal contact over the years with Mr. Armstrong. I have had only the best relationships with Mr. Stanley Rader. I would necessarily say to myself, well, look, just because somebody is baptized, I'm not going to entertain the idea that obviously he's not going to make it, he's headed for a lake of fire. I don't think that of some of you, no matter if some of you came out of the gutter. And we've had members. We had a member of long standing who's been held in honor in the church, who's died, who was an alcoholic before he was called, and he was a member of the Board of Trustees of the Church of God. Well, just because he's gone out of our life, many of you have never known it. But in that age, nobody questioned his conversion. Nobody questioned why it was unwise for him to drink. His wife, to my knowledge, is still living, so I won't mention the name at this point. It is not necessary. But this was no longer a problem when he became converted. You know, it was like rosary turned all over. He was not the same man anymore. It never occurred to us to question whether he would make it or not. Could we trust him? He was a responsible individual when God put his hand down and lifted him up out of the world in which he was. Now, in the same way, God has revealed things to Mr. Rader through his contacts with this work in a way he hasn't revealed to many. And let us give every opportunity to the man to show the development of the Spirit of God in him, which should normally count for any who are baptized. But after all, his baptism is not more than 2 years ago. And most people who were only... How many of you are in the church longer than 2 years in terms of baptism? Well, I think you understand. So before, I appreciate that because I thought that was true. You don't all look that old, but you do look spiritually that mature. So what we'll say is, before, and maybe this congregation doesn't have this problem, but I know it's one of the big problems wherever I go. People ask me, well, what about Stanley Rader? You know, why is he different, I say, from anybody else who has problems? His wife's not converted. Let's allow certain things to develop and see. Now, I know that Mr. Rader is involved financially in areas that I might consider borderline. Well, explain briefly so none of you need be concerned. I'm trying to leave the congregation here with enough information that you can maturely evaluate things. Witness Armstrong flies the G2, the Grumman 2. It's actually owned by a corporation headed by Mr. Rader. Well, that's an interesting thing. Oh, there he is again with his fingers in the financial pie. See, this is, you know, the arguments you hear around headquarters. What if the Church of God directly owned the plane, and what if we were in default? It would immediately go back to the corporation that would collect the debt, and we would have lost the plane. Suppose the Church gets into trouble financially, or for whatever reason, and there is a default on any payments to the plane. If something happens, it goes back to the owner, Stanley Rader. And we still have control. We still have the plane. And then what we work out is some refinancing of it, because he is able to handle it in the meantime. And whether or not we think that there might have been in times past, before his conversions, ulterior motives, I think we need to analyze it from another point of view, why Mr. Herbert Armstrong allowed some decision. Mr. Armstrong does not judge that every decision that Mr. Rader recommends must be seen as purely altruistic. I think Mr. Armstrong was not naive and assumed that Mr. Rader is the only one without any human weaknesses when these decisions were made. But when Mr. Armstrong agreed, he agreed for the good of the work. And I have said, ever since I heard about it, when this was mentioned to the ministers who were in a rebellious state in 1974, I would much rather know that if in any way the payments of the church fall into default, that it was possible for someone associated with the church still to have the plane available for Mr. Armstrong's use until we were able to negotiate something else. See? What would happen if the church came into default and the church properties were collected to pay some debts? You know, it's possible that enemies could prevent mail coming to this work and could go to the postal authorities. This is an ultimate evil we have had to think about over the many years as I've been in the church. Well, the answer is, since the plane isn't owned by the church, the plane can never be collected. If the plane was owned by the church, it could go into receivership. Therefore, there was a reason why Mr. Armstrong felt it advisable that probably one of the last instruments that he would have to use to get his job done should not be held in the name of the church. See what I mean? It protects it for any use, no matter what would happen to the church as a corporate entity in terms of receiving money. Therefore, if I discuss things here, probably what I'm saying is not necessarily as accurate as if Mr. Rader would explain the relationship. But I'm trying to deal with the principal. I'm not representing the business office. I'm only saying that based on what I know in general, based on how I would have to make a decision, I would say, look, if we can protect something like that by having it held by a corporation with its leading members, associated with the church whose interest in life is, members whose lives and interests are dedicated to the church, then let's hold it there and let's have the church, in a sense, pay this corporation, and in turn it pays the banks, you see? This way we protect certain things in a way we couldn't otherwise. I hope that you will take a look at it from that point of view. With respect to attitudes that developed when the first issue of Quest was seen in red, Mr. Armstrong was elated over it. When he saw the layout, he was disgusted with it when he read the text, in some cases, as some of you might have been. So let us face that maybe his reaction was no more different than yours. We have asked an outside responsibility, an outside group to exercise responsibility on the basis of their general attitude. Whether I would have done it that way is irrelevant. I'm not responsible for it. The point is, however, that we can either hire them or fire them, and if they don't finally do what we want, they're fired. That's the basis for it. Now, I want to explain something with respect to AICF. The purpose for having the magazine as it is was to make it self-supporting. And there's no reason the magazine could not be self-supporting, just like most magazines can be. I am sorry if, in a sense, that in having it self-supporting, we have to accept advertisement of some firms that I would have some doubts about. But we have to recognize that we're in a situation which I would like briefly to explain. And that is, what is the Ambassador International Cultural Foundation from a certain point of view? One, the Church of God is headed by Jesus Christ. AICF is not. Is that clear? It was never intended to be. All right, on this panel, if we lived in a society in which our monies were mostly our own to do with as we pleased without the high tax rate, God says that about 10% every third year, which is roughly 3% a year to use a round figure, you are expected to give to the needs of people, the widows, the fatherly, the elderly, the poor, the fatherless, all those in difficulty who have no normal means of support. We tend to do those things, and we also try to provide enough money through our third tithe so that there is some cultural life to the elderly. That is, we don't assume that the elderly must only have clothes, food, transportation to the feast, and a house to be in. We expect some cultural opportunities that they can go. We have an elderly man, some of you may know, old Peter Miller, who's well into his 80s now. We give him a gratis ticket, AICF, and he is a lover of good music. And sometimes I take him to the musical program, sometimes someone else does. And I come in and do that. I don't attend them. First place, I don't have the time, and I'm doing something else while he's there, and then I pick him up and return him. Sometimes the minister's function today is that of what we call a super deacon. But these are the things we do. Now, in this sense, what we provide through third tithe, as our tradition was, now this is apart from the issue of monies and welfare programs that go to the state and the government through taxes, but I'm talking about the way God set it out. We try to consider that what we provide is not the barest, bare-bones minimum, but something that will create an opportunity. What the church came to realize is that although we may never have thought of it on that basis, that there is the need for the church in areas that the church should not take its time up with. That is, where we don't train men and try to go around the world with certain good works, where indeed we don't even have people called in the church who have the contacts. What we choose to do is to create an institution in which we try to achieve an awareness of good works of various levels, cultural as well as the many others that we could cite, where, as it turns out, in this last budget year, the church donated about 3% of its total income. And we have an income of $60 million, to use a round figure, which is not necessarily the income in the U.S. I'm using a round figure somewhere between income in U.S. and worldwide. 3%, that's $1.8 million, or we might spend somewhere between $1.5 and $2 million in good works around the world. Now, if we were to try to be of help to people who are fatherless in some countries, it wouldn't do us very much good. If we take some lonely church member who doesn't even understand the social program in the country, because that's not his job. AICF was created to include men at government level, to include men at a high cultural level, to include men who are involved in welfare programs, princes and kings, or however we want to put it, who know where the major problems and needs are. And it is therefore under Mr. Armstrong's general supervision, but by no means fundamental. To his insight, we would ask the insight of others in various fields, and they pool their knowledge and spend the money on the basis. But in Southern California, with the college there and with a fine auditorium, the obvious function of Southern California is to create a cultural impact for people, and we have provided, in some cases, free occasions for school children in the whole Los Angeles area. We have provided opportunities for the elderly. And we have drawn attention to the cultural impact of the college, to the cultural students. Now, I know Dr. Meredith can go around in Southern California and looking for halls for the church and find that 18 out of 20 people who run local halls and catering services don't know the college. That's very sad in that business. I can be in my area where I deal with book dealers, where I deal, in times past and made friends among them, where I deal with educators, where I deal with archaeologists and museum keepers, and I have had contact with all these people on the basis of my relationship to the college in times past, where I meet nobody who doesn't know about it. Everyone does. They either know AICF, the Worldwide Church, or Ambassador College, or they've heard the name Garnet Head. That's just a different environment. And so we are more widely known than we realize, and we are known especially because of AICF in Southern California. But when we come to the state of Israel, Mr. Armstrong spent money there to help, and we worked through the man who's in charge of the ICCY. This has been written up before. This is an organization devoted to international cultural contacts between the youth, ICCY, of the Arab community and the Israelis. We have spent money where the Israeli government didn't even have it to provide wheelchairs for soldiers that could no longer get around and be a part of the community. We have provided money for medical services, irrespective, you see, of our view of medicine, for the reason that in Lebanon this was the greatest need. And certainly during the time of the Civil War, one of the greatest tragedies was the need of even healing people, irrespective of disease, just the physical injuries that occur in a civil war. In the hills of Thailand and Nepal, we spent it in education for schools, because apart from education, there wouldn't even be a people who could read the Bible. That's where you have to start. And we started out by trying to get these people off of producing opium and into producing apricots and squash and potatoes and corn. Now, I know you can find fault with Quest, and I will too. And I hope that we can make some correction. But we could not do these things for people and bring ourselves to the attention if indeed we had not asked some responsible people around the world to participate and to open up doors. So in this sense, the church felt it better that instead of creating a directly church-controlled organization in entirety, we would do something that in fact would allow for local development to an extent to reach the world in an area where we become known as making a contribution and being concerned for some fundamental programs that are of benefit. Because we couldn't start out by putting the plain truth on the news racks in these countries. There was no television or radio, and there was no way to hold a public speech. What are you going to do in a Buddhist country who's never seen a Bible? Illustration. So, all these things were created for intents and purposes, and I think we need to see them in this light. Therefore, in closing, I would like to summarize the fact that we are now in a state where we have too many people in the church who have allowed themselves the luxury of questioning what really isn't their responsibility, much as women who seek to exercise what a man's duty is. And then on the other hand, we probably have had more than enough of our share of responsible individuals in the church who haven't been as aware, been too busy, or maybe a little careless, and have made mistakes in the sense of postponing decisions that would have been better made earlier, much like some wives might well have advised their husbands, and husbands delay making a decision until it's nearly too late and you have to have some help, see. But we all need to play a role to make it work out better and do our part. And we appreciate very much the part that has been done, and I think Mr. Herbert Armstrong made it plain that in his estimation, because many of our decisions were made later, because there hasn't been this growth, there has been a spiritual neglect or fault finding, or a failure to anticipate it at the administrative level, and a failure to fully comprehend the impact of inflation in time. So we have to abandon certain programs. We have to abandon them under pressure instead of sufficiently in time where the pressure is eased. But maybe the pressure is good for us as brethren in order to get our part in the work improved. I hope we will take a new look at what our real roles are and our attitudes and matters toward people or ideas that are in circulation, and to be sure that we focus in on the fact that this is the work of God, which is also doing on the side a good work, which is an entirely different view. I believe that this congregation has, from my brief experience before and under the present leadership, certainly maintained a very fine quality of response. I sense that here. And I do hope that all those who are responsible for your welfare will themselves set an example. I know Mr. Baird has always tried to in my contacts with him, and I think that in that sense you are very blessed with having him here. And his wife, in my estimation, was certainly one of the leading women in the Fresno Church. I would say that happy that Aaron O'Dell and his wife can be here, and for younger people will hopefully set the kind of example. I appreciate very much the fact that he has always been willing to tell me about his weaknesses and strengths in years past and to confide in me for help, and we have been friends ever since. I appreciate very much what he is able to do, and I hope that other young people can follow his example in terms of responsibility, jobs, and a role locally. There's no reason why some of the problems that beset the church should ever need to start here. But I want to lay the cards out on the table enough and have you look at them enough that, and I hope I haven't offended anybody with the use of cards. I don't bother, I haven't played cards in a long time, and I really never knew anything but flinch. That's not my interest. But I do feel that we should take a broad look, and whether I have explained everything as accurately as I might like, because I've not been involved in the background of every one of these areas, I'm trying to state it in terms of at least the subject areas that are too often in the realm of doctrine, and I want to take a new look at why. And I think we should be able to take this approach to any new thing that may come along in the work or that we hear and that we maintain our spiritual balance and focus in on Christianity in this sense as a total way of life, or as is put down, I think, I don't know if you've read that particular verse too, in 2 Peter 2:15, there are people who have forsaken the right way. And the right way is a very broad approach to life in terms of covering everything that we will ultimately do, including every idle word we speak. And the way we go, in one sense, by contrast to the world, is very narrow in terms of what we allow ourselves. We follow Christ, but it covers everything that we do in life.